Origens Mechanicus. Later histories would record that the first blow of the Martian Civil War was struck against Magos Matia Kefra, whose forge in the Sinus Sabaeus region was housed within the Mardla crater. Titans of the Magna Legion marched from the southern Noachus region and within minutes had smashed down the gates of his forge. Howling engines daubed in red, orange, yellow, and black, and decorated with flaming horned skull devices, ran amok within the high walls of the crater, crushing everything living beneath them and destroying thousands of years of accumulated wisdom in a fury of fire. Vast libraries burned and weapon shops that served the Solar Guard were reduced to molten slag as the indiscriminate slaughter continued long into the night, the Magna Legion's trumpeting warhorns sounding like the atavistic screams of primitive savages. Further north in the Arabian region, the great engine yards of High Magos Ahotep in the Cassini crater were struck by 100 missiles launched from the atomic silos secreted within the isolated peaks and mesas of Nilo Syrtis. The explosions of the forbidden weapons filled the 415-kilometer diameter of the crater with seething nuclear fire and sent conjoined magma-streaked mushroom clouds soaring nearly 70 kilometers into the sky. Along the borders of the Lunai Palace and Arcadia regions, what had previously been confined to heated debate erupted into outright warfare as Princeps Ulrike of the Deathstalkers unleashed his engines upon the fortress of Maxen Vledig's Deathbolts. Caught by surprise, the Deathbolts lost 19 engines in the first hour of battle, before withdrawing into the frozen wastes of the Mare Boreum and seeking refuge in the dune fields of Olympia Undi. Their calls for reinforcement went unanswered, for all of Mars was tearing itself apart as the plague of war spread across the planet in a raging firestorm. Amid the Athabasca valleys, war machines of Legio Ignatum and the Burning Stars fought in bloody close quarters through the teardrop landforms caused by catastrophic flooding in an earlier ancient age of the Red Planet. Neither force could gain the advantage, nor could either claim victory, so, after a night's undignified scrapping, both withdrew to lick their wounds. A snapping, howling host of twisted Skitari and hideously altered weaponized servitors surged from the Gigas Sulci subhives of Olympus Mons to attack the crater forges of Epluvium Maximal. Alert to the danger of attack, Maximal's forces repelled the first waves of attackers, but within hours his forge was surrounded and under siege by unholy Ordinatus engines and warped machines given hideous life in the depths of the Fabricator General's darkest and bloodiest weapon shops. The greatest single loss of life took place in the Ismenius Lacus region of Mars, where the glacial forges of Adept Ruion Vilnaris were attacked by air-bursting rockets, carrying a mutated strain of the Life Eater. The rapacious viral organism leapt from victim to victim with malicious glee, seeming to travel via every possible vector. Via direct contact, it killed the tens of thousands directly exposed to the detonation in minutes. Airborne, it depopulated the millions-strong worker habs of Deuteronulus Mensae within 3 hours, and through some diabolical warp mutation, it spread through the haptic networks to infect even those who thought themselves safe behind vax-sealed barriers. When the gleeful virus finally burnt itself out, some 7 hours later, every living soul within Ismenius Lacus was dead, the remains of 14 million liquefied corpses freezing solid where they lay. Within the Herschel impact basin of the Mare Tirrenum, 900,000 Skitari and protectors clashed in a swirling bloody melee that continued unabated until almost all were dead. No victor emerged from the senseless slaughter, and no purpose was served by the destruction. Yet still, both factions poured their forces into the meat grinder for fear of what might be lost should they withdraw. Nor was the fighting merely confined to the surface of Mars. The Ring of Iron, that great halo shipyard that surrounded the Red Planet like a glittering silver belt, shuddered as explosions and conflict spread along its length. Factions loyal to the throne, and those sworn to Olympus Mons and Horus Lupercal, clashed with the fury of fanatics. The vessels of Battlefleet Solar pulled away from the fighting as Mechanicum ships dueled in the shadow of the Ring of Iron, pounding one another with devastating broadsides and no thought of strategy or survival. Venting gases and bodies spilled from ruptured hulls, and thousands died every second as wounded ships fell from low orbit and streaked down through the atmosphere to their destruction. The flaming wreckage of Mechanicum Gloriam, its engines destroyed as it sought to evade a hunting pack of frigates in low orbit, plunged through the lightning-racked skies of Mars towards the planet's surface. The techno-theologians, watching its fall from the Basilica of the Blessed Algorithm in the Sidonia Mensae region, proclaimed it a sign of the machine god's wrath, raising their manip arms and mechadendrites in praise of this wondrous sign of divine displeasure. Calls for peace and a cease of hostilities were carried far and wide across Mars, broadcast on every channel by every means available to them. That signal was abruptly cut short as Mechanicum Gloriam slammed into the basilica and obliterated the vast complex of temples, shrines, and reliquaries in a heartbeat. Millions of square kilometers and billions of faithful priests were consumed in the explosive impact, and any last call to reason vanished with them in the newest and deepest impact crater to disfigure the Martian soil. All across Mars, in every region where the Mechanicum had built its holdings, the ancient order tore at itself in a frenzy of bloodletting, more savage than any alien race had dared inflict on humanity. Libraries of priceless knowledge burned. Adepts whose expertise had helped free the human race from confinement to its birth planet were torn limb from limb by screaming mobs, and forges that had previously sworn undying pacts of allegiance turned on one another like lifelong foes. Burning debris from orbit fell to the planet's surface, and though it was said that it never rained on Mars, a rain of fire now filled the heavens as though the sky wept comet tears that it should bear witness to such destruction. Sitting next to Caxton in the bucket seats fitted in the cramped rear compartment of their salvaged Cargo 5, Dahlia fought to stay awake as the rugged, dusty vista of the Sirius Planum sped past, rendered grainy and blurred through the scratched glass of the compartment's windows. The ground was uneven, but Romeo-31 guided them expertly across the rocky plains. Severine sat on the other side of Caxton, her broken arm bound close to her chest, while Zouche sat up front in the driver's cabin next to Romeo-31. In the aftermath of the cabin machine's attack, her protector had pulled himself from the metal that impaled his shoulder and quickly dragged them from the wreckage of the maglev. Working with practiced urgency, he had ascertained the extent of their injuries and moved them to a hidden culvert in the tunnel walls. As Romeo-31 and Zouche searched the rear cargo holds of the maglev for anything useful in the wreckage, Severine had stared at Dahlia with an expression of awe and what Dahlia would later realize was fear.
"How did you do that?" asked Severine. "Send that machine away, I mean. I thought we were all dead."
"We should have been," agreed Caxton. "Maybe it missed us, or there was some kind of interference, I don't know."
Severine shook her head, biting her lip as the pain of her broken arm flared.
"No, it was something Dahlia did, I know it." "What did you do?"
"I don't understand it myself, to be honest," said Dahlia,
leaning her head back on the cold stone of the tunnel wall.
"It was as if I could see the mechanisms of its mind, and I just knew how it worked. I saw what Crom had done to it, and I kind of blinded it to the fact we were right in front of it."
"Crom?" said Severine. "Lucas Crom? He built that machine? A thinking machine?"
"Yes," said Dahlia. "I could see his handiwork all over its mind."
"Why would an adept like Crom want to kill us?"
"Not us," said Caxton.
"Dahlia." Severine looked at Dahlia as though she had personally broken her arm.
"Why haven't you told us, Dahlia? Why does Lucas Crom want you dead?"
Dahlia knew nothing she said would convince Severin that she didn't know for sure, but she shrugged and said,
"I'm guessing here, but I think maybe it's something to do with Adept Zeth's Akashic Reader. Some people don't want it built, and I think they're afraid of what's going to happen when we know everything it can show us. Think about it. If everyone can know everything, then what happens to the keepers of knowledge? Knowledge is power, right? So what happens when everyone can access that knowledge?"
"They'd lose their power,"
said Caxton. Exactly, said Dahlia. And I'm surer than ever that whatever the creature beneath the Noctis Labyrinthus is, it's the key to making the Akashic Reader work. People are frightened of what we'll be able to achieve when we unlock its potential, and they're desperate to hang on to what they've got.
So what's all that got to do with what's happening all over Mars?
I don't know, said Dahlia. I really don't, but whatever it is, it's bigger than all of us.
At that moment, Romeo-31 and Zouche had returned laden with a veritable treasure trove of useful items recovered from the unclaimed supplies, earmarked for Crater Edge and Red Gorge. Medicaid packs, ration cartons, water recyclers, and breathing apparatus. The Medicaid packs were opened and wounds cleaned and treated with counterseptic before being bound with gauze and bandages. Best of all, Zouche had discovered an overturned Cargo 5 all-terrain hauler, an unreliable and cantankerous vehicle common in the frontier towns and less affluent forges, but one which offered them a chance of survival. Romeo-31 easily righted the vehicle, but upon doing so, they discovered that the indiscriminate fire of their attacker had severed the track unit and held the mechanics of the driver's controls. Undaunted, Zouche set to work repairing the damaged track unit with Romeo-31's help, while Caxton dismantled the control panel and set to work with Dahlia, trying to jury-rig the controls back to life. Using spars of metal from the wrecked maglev, Romeo-31 groaned with effort as he lifted the Cargo 5 enough for the others to pull the repaired track links through, and they had cheered and embraced when Caxton finally ignited the drive plant and the engine turned over with a belligerent growl. Stocking up the rear compartments of the Cargo 5 with their supplies, they had driven along the darkness of the tunnel and emerged into a freshly broken morning. Dahlia had never been happier to see open sky, though the scarlet hue of the dawn and the cascades of fire she saw in the distance spoke of deeper troubles to come. As Romeo-31 negotiated the Cargo 5 down the rugged slope leading to the Syria Planum, Dahlia and the others had their first glimpse of Mondas Gamma Forge Complex. Like a dark slick, it spread south and east across the landscape in a vast swathe of smoking, flaming industry. Hive manufactories, vast weapon hangars, and blazing foundries pounded and throbbed with the labor of production. One of the largest forges on Mars, its furthest extremities were beyond sight, a black pall of shrouding smoke clinging to the fabrication plants and sub-hives, as though unwilling to let outsiders view what lay beneath. The sight was profoundly disturbing, for Dahlia knew this was the domain of Adept Lucas Crom, the builder of the machine that had just tried to kill them. Despite that, a newfound vigor filled Dahlia, though whether this was in response to their brush with death or some other reason, she couldn't tell. All she knew was that she was alive, and all the things she had feared losing were still there, just waiting to be experienced. The same mood seemed to suffuse them all, and over the next few hours of their journey, as the ground leveled out and they made good time across the plain, each of her fellow companions relaxed into this new stage of their journey. Even Severine, whose arm was still painful despite Romeo-31's ministrations and the effects of a couple of painkillers, seemed in better spirits. The air in the vehicle was clammy, yet it was better than the hot dust that billowed around them outside. This far from the Pallidus, the atmosphere outside wasn't actually poisonous, but it wasn't exactly pleasant. Dahlia felt a growing sense of optimism that they were going to reach their goal after all, as the hours blurred into days and the unending dust clouds enveloped them. The days passed mostly in silence, though occasionally one of them would point out a particularly interesting formation or unusual sight, and they would talk about it until it was obscured in the dust of their wake. Romeo-31 kept one eye on the distant forge, and Dahlia felt a growing excitement as the ground became rockier. At length, Romeo-31 slowed the Cargo 5 and pointed to a dark scar in the earth that dropped sharply into the ground between two descending cliffs of rock. The western entrance to the Noctis Labyrinthus, said Romeo-31.
Well, we made it here, said Severine. What now?
Dahlia looked at the tense faces of her friends. They had come this far, but looking into the tomb-like darkness of the Noctis Labyrinthus, she could see their fear and hesitation at war with their desire to stand by her.
"We go in. What else is there to do?" asked Caxton. "We've come all this way, and we can't turn back. Right, Dahlia?"
"Right," said Dahlia,
grateful for his support.
"Fine by me," said Zouche. "Pointless journey if we don't go in."
Severine nodded slowly, and Romeo-31 guided their vehicle down the sloping entrance to the canyon system. The ground dropped away sharply, swallowing them whole as the light faded and left them traveling in a twilight wilderness of shadows and thin bars of diffuse light that filtered down from high above. Sheer cliffs of layered rock soared above them, and Dahlia felt like they were plunging deeper and deeper into the heart of the planet through some dreadful, unhealed wound. Maven could barely contain his anger at the sight of so many bodies. The tunnel was choked with them, lying scattered in pieces or crushed amid the twisted wreckage of a maglev that had been blasted from the track. He rode Equitos Bellum through the darkness, his twin stablights illuminating the tunnel in the dusty armored carapace of Pax Mortis.
"You still think we're following dead spore?" he voxed to Cronus.
His battle brother didn't answer for a moment, and Maven sensed his friend's fury at what he was seeing. The maglev hadn't just been attacked. It had been obliterated. Weapons of tremendous power had torn it open from end to end and slaughtered every living soul within.
"With all that's happening across Mars, and even after what we found in the Palladus, I'll admit I was beginning to regret my decision to follow you," said Cronus. "But no more, brother. Whatever that machine is, it has to be destroyed. This will not stand."
Maven nodded in agreement, though, truth to tell, even he had begun to doubt the instincts of his mount as it led them deeper and deeper into the Palladus. Then, after days of fruitless searching, his Auspex had fizzed and hissed with the familiar spider-like pattern of electromagnetic energy that was their prey's signature. The buried wreck of a prospector's hauler had been almost completely obscured by the dust storms, but Equitos Bellum had scented the handiwork of its nemesis in its destruction. No sooner had the knight's Auspex sniffed at the residue of reactor, shield, and weapons than Maven felt its gnawing desire to travel eastwards over the mountainous ridge between Tharsis and the Syria Planum in an aching pull of the manifold. Now they had found this corpse-filled tunnel, a charnel house of senseless slaughter, and still the manifold pulled them onwards.
"Why hasn't anyone come to help?" wondered Maven. "Why have they just left them?" "Mars has bigger problems," replied Cronus. "You've heard the feeds. It's civil war."
Maven heard the warring desires in his friend's voice and felt the same turmoil within his own heart. The inload feeds had been jammed with a million clamoring voices. Declarations of war, pleas for aid, and feral screams of hatred. The Martian forges, which had stood shoulder to shoulder through uncounted epochs of darkness and weathered those storms intact, were now doing to one another what old knight could not. Duty to their order told Maven they should abandon their quest and ride west with all speed to join their fellow knights in defense of the Magma City. But honor told him that once begun, a quest could never be abandoned, only completed. Maven felt the angry pull of Equitos Bellum and knew which imperative he must obey.
"It's closer," he said. "I can feel it."
"Then let's get after it,"
said Cronus, riding towards the Syria Planum.
"The sooner we kill it, the sooner we can rejoin our brothers."
The Cargo 5 rolled onwards through the soaring canyons of the Noctis Labyrinthus, the darkness always seeming to draw it further and further in, as an ambush predator lures its prey. The darkness was cold, and the cabin's tiny heater did little to take the edge off the chill. But after the dusty, clammy journey across the Syria Planum, no one was complaining yet. The deeper they went, the colder it became, and white webs of hoarfrost formed on the windows, a phenomenon none of them had ever seen before. Romeo-31 was forced to divert valuable battery power to the heater to keep the glass clear and see where he was going. The headlights of the Cargo 5 stuttered, barely piercing the gloom, and the atmosphere within the cabin grew stuffy and unpleasant as the air recycler failed. Hour after hour passed, and though there was nothing resembling a roadway, the base of the Graben was relatively flat, and the Cargo 5 devoured the kilometers. Whenever they came to a branching canyon, Dahlia would direct Romeo-31 with a nod of the head, as though afraid to disturb the sepulchral silence that filled the Noctis Labyrinthus. No one questioned how she knew where she was going. Grating static hissed from the oil-stained vox, and Zeus reached down to turn it off before looking over his shoulder with a puzzled expression.
"Strange. It's not even on."
Melisin did say the adepts in this region left because of technical problems, said Caxton.
His words were said lightly, but served only to heighten their unease. More mechanical glitches plagued them as the journey continued, though the passage of time after the first 2 days in the darkness was hard to judge after everyone's chronometers failed at exactly the same moment. Several hours later, the cabin's internal lights sputtered and died as they made a treacherous descent into an even deeper, shadow-thickened canyon, unleavened by sunlight. The darkness closed in on them utterly, and Dahlia felt as though a cloak was being drawn around them while a host of black ghosts followed and watched from the shadows. Each of them felt 1,000 eyes upon them, the hairs on the backs of their necks erect and screaming danger, though nothing threatening was visible. Several times along the way the engine coughed and died, and each time it had to be coaxed back to life by an increasingly frustrated and nervous Caxton. Despite the mechanical problems and the sullen, apprehensive mood that settled upon everyone in the gloom, Dahlia felt a mounting sense of excitement with each kilometre that passed. They had seen no daylight and no hint of anything resembling their final objective, but with the certainty of a zealot, Dahlia knew they were close. She had no idea how deep they had penetrated into the Noctis Labyrinthus. The odometer had failed the previous day, or where they were in relation to any other living thing on Mars, but a growing ache in the back of her mind told her they were close. The rumble of the engine cut out again, and Dahlia heard Caxton groan as he prepared to venture out into the cold and the dark to get it restarted. Romeo 31 shook his head. No need. We're not going any further. The battery's dead.
So what do we do now? Asked Severine, a shrill edge to her voice.
It's all right, said Dahlia,
leaning forward and wiping her hand across the cold glass of the driver's cabin.
Look!
Ahead of the lifeless Cargo 5, a sheer cliff towered over them, its walls sparkling as though studded with nuggets of quartz. But this was no ordinary wall of rock, Dahlia realized. Its surface was smooth, like fused glass, and it shone with a faint internal light. Sections of the cliff had fallen away over the eons, exposing a darkened passage that cleft the rock, and from which a strange mist sighed like steam from a geothermal vent.
The breath of the dragon, said Dahlia. We've arrived.
The Himadri precinct encircled the great hollow mountain of the Himalaya at the crown of Terra, a mighty concourse of black, glassy marble lined with busts and statues of cowled figures. Veins of gold and red and blue threaded the marble, and 1,000 honor banners hung from the kilometer-high roof of shadowed arches and iron vaults. Cold light spilled into the vast chamber through tall windows, twice as large as a warlord titan, throwing out great spars of brightness across the tiled floor of black-and-white terrazzo. The light fell on the towering warrior in gold, who marched along its length in the company of a smaller, white-haired man who wore the simple robes of a palace administrator. The giant wore a magnificent suit of golden armor, wrought by the finest craftsmen and embellished with finery scrimshawed by the greatest artisans of the imperial fists. A mantle of red velvet, edged with bronze weave, hung around his shoulders, and his silver hair gleamed in contrast to the luster of his armor. The warrior's face was craggy and tanned, browned by the light of unnumbered suns, and carved in an expression of stoic determination. His companion was as unremarkable as the warrior was exceptional, his white hair worn long like a mane, and his shoulders stooped with the weight of the world. Behind this unlikely pair marched a detachment of 10 custodians in bronze armor and scarlet-plumed helms who carried long-bladed polearms. Their presence was a formality, for Rogel Dorn, Primarch of the Imperial Fists, needed no protection. Of all the great precincts of the Emperor's Palace, the Himadri was one of the few not to have been turned into a fortress by the Golden Warrior, though that fact was scant comfort to him, saw his companion, Malkador the Sigillite, Regent of Terra. Malkador saw the wonder in Dorn's eyes as they passed beneath the chivalric arch and the 10,000 names of its builders inlaid with gold onto the marble. Behind that wonder, he also saw sadness.
The glory of the Emperor's fastness will rise from the ashes of this war like a phoenix, said Malkador, guessing his friend's thoughts.
Dorn looked down at him and smiled wearily. Sorry.
I was just calculating how long it would take to dismantle the great archway and replace it with a bastion gateway.
I know you were,
nodded Malkador, lacing his hands behind his back as they passed beneath the arch.
So, how long would it take?
If my fists did the work, perhaps 2 days, said Dorn. But let's hope it doesn't come to that. If the traitor's forces reach this far, then we have already lost.
The Emperor trusts you not to let that happen.
I will not, agreed Dorn.
They walked in silence for some time, content to enjoy the view of the mountains against the rare sight of a blue sky and the many wonders contained within the Himadri precinct. The throne globe of Mad King Peshkin of Tali, the colonnade of heroes, the last flying machine of the Roma, preserved in a shimmering stasis field, and 100 other wonders and trophies taken in the Wars of Unity.
The Emperor still does not join us, asked Dorn, as they passed the blood-stained armor of pearl that had been torn from the body of the warlord Caligan.
Malkador sighed. He had been waiting for this question.
No, my friend, he does not.
Tell me why, Sigilite, demanded Dorn. His empire is crumbling and his brightest bastard son is dragging half the galaxy into war. What could possibly be more important?
I have no answer for you, said Malkador, save the Emperor's word that nothing is more important than his labors in the palace vaults. Not Horus, not you, and certainly not I.
Then we are alone.
No, said Malkador, not alone. Never alone. The Emperor may not stand beside us, but he has given us the means to fight this war and win it. Horus has 3 of his brother legions with him. You have your fists and 13 others.
Would that it were 15, mused Dorn.
Do not even think it, my friend, warned Malkador. They are lost to us forever.
I know, said Dorn. And you are right. By any simple reckoning of numbers, the traitor stands little chance of victory. But he was always the most cunning, the one most likely to find a way where no others could.
Is that what you're really afraid of?
Perhaps, whispered Dorn. I do not yet know what I am afraid of. And that worries me.
Malkador waved a hand along the length of the Himadri precinct, towards the grim, black portal at its end, their ultimate destination.
Mayhap the master of the Astro Telepathica will have more news of the legions.
He'd better, said Dorn. After the sacrifices we've made to pierce the storms in the warp, there had better be some news of Sanguinius and the Lion.
And Gilliman, and Russ, added Malkador.
I'm not worried about them. They can look after themselves, said Dorn. But the others were heading into danger when last I knew of their plans, and it grieves me that I cannot reach them. I need to gather the legions to strike at the heart of the traitor.
You still plan to take the fight to Horus Lupercal?
After what he did to Istvan III, it is the only way, said Dorn, almost flinching at the sound of his former brother's name. Kill the head, and the body will die.
Maybe so. But we have problems closer to home to deal with first.
You speak of the uprisings on Mars?
I do, confirmed Malkador. High Adept Epluvium Maximal contacts me daily with word of further atrocities and loss of knowledge. War has come to the Red Planet.
There is no word from the Fabricator General.
None that makes any kind of sense. I fear he is against us now.
This Maximal, how reliable is he?
Malkador shrugged.
How reliable is anything these days? I know Maximal of old, and though he is prone to exaggeration, he is a staunch Emperor's man, and I believe he speaks the truth. Mars burns with rebellion.
Then we need to secure the solar system before looking to make war in a far-off system.
What do you propose? Asked Malkador.
I shall send Sigismund and my 4 companies of the Imperial Fists to secure the forges of Mars. Mondus Oculum and Mondus Gamma produce the bulk of the armor and weapons of the Astartes. We will strike there to capture those forges, and when they are ours, we will push onwards and secure the others.
Sigismund? A trifle volatile, is he not? Asked Malkador. Might not a mission to Mars benefit from a cooler head than his?
Dorne smiled, a rare sight in these bleak times.
My first captain is prone to bellicose talk, aye, but I will send Camber Diaz with him. He will provide a steadying influence on Sigismund. Will that suffice to allay your concerns? Malkador nodded.
Of course. You are the commander of the Imperium's armed forces, and you have my full confidence. But even a humble administrator such as I knows that you will need more warriors than four companies of Imperial fists to pacify Mars.
We can bulk out the force with regiments of Imperial Army and auxiliary units stationed on Terra and the moons of Saturn and Jupiter.
And perhaps Sor Talgron's word-bearers?
No, said Dorne. I need his warriors for the assault on Istvan V. Malkador paused and looked through one of the soaring windows as the sun began to set behind the tallest peak of the world.
Who could have believed it would come to this? He asked.
No one could have foreseen this, said Dorne. Not even the Emperor.
If we cannot stop the Warmaster, then everything we have built over the last 3 centuries will be lost, my friend. All our grand achievements and the great dream of unity will turn to ash if we fail. We will perish by our own hands, or else be devoured by a tide of alien insurgents, unable to mount more than a token resistance against the ghoulish hordes.
Then we cannot afford to fail, said Dorne. Malkador turned to face Dorne and looked up into his handsome, weathered features.
Send your warriors to Mars, Rogel Dorne. Secure the Martian forges, and then crush the life from Horus Lupercal on Istvan V.
Dorne bowed towards him.
It shall be done, he promised.